This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, June 29, 2007. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. The Lebanese army opens fire and kills two Palestinian protesters. We'll hear from Beirut. Residents in Hong Kong mark the territory's 10th anniversary handover to China.
It is a day for celebration as well as for us to express our aspiration for democracy.
And we'll hear what the Democratic presidential candidates have to say on race and class.
If HIV/AIDS were the leading cause of death of white women between the ages of 25 and 34, there would be an outraged outcry in this country.
Those stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with today's headlines. The Supreme Court has agreed to hear arguments regarding whether Guantanamo Bay detainees can challenge their confinement in U.S. civilian courts. The court refused to hear a similar case in April. The justices gave no explanation today for the rare reversal. The case could go before the Supreme Court as early as this fall. Almost 2 years after the London bombings, police have found and defused a car bomb in the English capital. From London, Naomi Fowler reports.
It was in London's main nightlife district and could have killed many people if it had gone off. There was no warning, and the bomb, made from gas cylinders, 60 litres of petrol and nails, was only discovered because a member of the public reported the abandoned car as suspicious. So far, no group has claimed responsibility, and police say it's too early to speculate. But the security services have been worried about the possibility of Baghdad-style car bombs in the capital. They've been carrying out random checks on vehicles for some time. The bomb is the first major security incident faced by Britain's new Prime Minister Gordon Brown, who's only 2 days into the job.
We should allow the police to investigate this incident and then report to us. But this incident does recall the need for us to be vigilant at all times and the public to be alert at any potential incidents. And I will stress to the Cabinet that the vigilance must be maintained over these next few days.
The new Home Secretary is meeting with the government's Emergency Response Committee today. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
A well-known critic of Pakistan's president has announced plans to file a lawsuit against those suspected of causing his forced disappearance and detention. Devon Terrior reports.
Khalid Khawaja, an outspoken critic of Pakistan's President General Pervez Musharraf and former member of the Pakistani intelligence services, was released without charge this week from 5 months of imprisonment. A Pakistani court ordered him released on bail in February, but Khawaja was instead placed in the custody of a Pakistani intelligence agency. The government leveled 5 successive sets of charges against him during his imprisonment, including distributing pamphlets inciting sectarian violence. Mr. Khawaja believes his detention came in retaliation for his advocacy on behalf of families of the over 200 individuals who have been abducted by the Pakistani authorities. Mr. Khawaja's sudden disappearance in January 2007 was taken up by the Chief Justice of Pakistan, Iftikhar Chaudhry, prior to the Chief Justice's controversial removal from office by Musharraf last March. Mr. Khawaja plans to take legal action against the officials involved in his abduction. For FSRN, this is Devon Terrio Orr reporting.
Indigenous people throughout Canada are participating in a National Day of Action to bring attention to issues facing the country's native communities. Stephen Christoph reports from Montreal.
The National Day of Action is an initiative of the Assembly of First Nations, an organization representing Indigenous communities throughout Canada. Marches are taking place in Montreal, Vancouver, and the national capital, Ottawa. Demonstrations in Montreal targeted the Conservative governments of Canada, widely unpopular amongst Aboriginal communities due to cuts in language, educational, and economic development programs. Actions in rural areas have been more militant. Last night, Mohawks from the community of Tayandinega set up physical blockades across a major Ontario rail line and secondary highway about 200 kilometers east of Toronto, sparking national media coverage. Further demonstrations are planned throughout the weekend in urban centers, including actions from the Native Youth Movement. This is Stefan Christoph reporting for Free Speech Radio News in Montreal.
South Korean and U.S. officials are expected to sign a bilateral trade deal this weekend in Washington. The agreement could be the largest FTA since NAFTA. In Korea, tens of thousands of workers opposed to the trade deal have walked off the job in protest. Jason Strother has the latest from Seoul.
South Korea's 150,000 member metal workers union called for several hours of work stoppage on Thursday and Friday in opposition to the free trade deal. The group, which represents many Koreans in the automotive sector, says that their business will be hurt by American car imports. Negotiators made last-minute changes to the trade deal today. President Bush needs to have the agreement signed by Saturday, when his fast-track authority expires, in order to present the bill to Congress for a yes or no vote without the option for amendments. The deal is expected to pass in the South Korean parliament, but it faces strong opposition from some Democrats in the U.S. Congress. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jason Strother in Seoul, South Korea.
A month-long miner strike in Peru has turned deadly for strike supporters and police alike. From Lima, Pamela Cueva has the story.
1,200 workers from Peru's Casapalca mine began the year strike on May 28 in response to the firing of 400 workers. Strikers closed the main highway and took over a number of buildings. Tensions have been high since June 16, when police killed four people while trying to dismantle a roadblock. The dead included a one-year-old boy and an elderly woman. Police returned to the roadblock yesterday, and one policeman was killed by a rock fired from a slingshot. The strikers are demanding social security, a reduction of their working hours, overtime pay, and the rehiring of the 400 who were fired. Townspeople in Huarochirí, where the mine is located, support the strike as they have for years accused the mining company of large-scale pollution in their community. As the situation becomes increasingly tense, the Peruvian Department of Labor has announced that it will investigate alleged anti-union practices at the mine. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Pamela Cueva with Alfredo Cuadros from Lima, Peru.
And I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
The Lebanese army opened fire on Palestinian protesters today at the Bedouin refugee camp in northern Lebanon, leaving two dead and more than 30 wounded. This was the second day of a three-day water-only hunger strike to show solidarity with the refugees trapped inside the Nahr al-Bared refugee camp, where the Lebanese army and the Sunni Muslim Islamic group Fatah al-Islam have been engaged in a six-week conflict. FSRN's Simba Russo has more from Beirut.
The army attack came during a protest by Palestinians at the Badawi refugee camp.
But when the gunfire started, I mean, it was automatic, uninterrupted gunfire for 2 to 3 minutes. People dispersed. And then when the gunfire ended, and we saw, obviously, that there were numerous wounded people on the road, we went back to the road with our arms raised in the air, amongst us, a number of women. And as we tried to remove the bodies, they started firing again. And it was during that process that more people were wounded.
Quiba Butterfly is one of the hunger strike organizers.
There was no direct provocation of the army. There was no dialogue with the army. They were far enough away from us that we could barely see their faces.
Demonstrators are demanding the right to return and an end to the destruction of their homes. The three-day water-only fast is also a response to the ongoing siege of Nahr al-Bared refugee camp, where aid groups have expressed concern for the looming humanitarian crisis for the 3,000 civilians who remain trapped in the camp. Badawi residents were left homeless after fighting between the Lebanese army and Fatah al-Islam forced them to flee the Nahr al-Bared refugee camp, which has been turned into a war zone.
It was a demonstration about the situation happening at the Nahr al-Bared camp, so the civil associations organized this demonstration because the situation is getting worse.
Ahla Zaidan is a resident of the Nahr al-Bared refugee camp, who was forced to leave to the nearby Badawi camp. He was also a witness to today's shooting.
There were rumors that a third party fired from the building towards the protesters, but instead it went towards the ground and bounced towards the army. And that's why the army thought that they were firing at them, so they fired back.
According to the Lebanese army, the soldiers were preventing the demonstrators from approaching a closed checkpoint at the entrance of the Nahr al-Bared refugee camp. Lebanon has 12 refugee camps housing more than 400,000 Palestinians who fled their homes when Israel was created in 1948. The current month-long conflict at the camps has killed 75 soldiers, 59 militants, and an unknown number of Palestinian civilians. Aid agencies argue that even if fighting were to stop, the dangers posed by unexploded ordnances and damaged buildings would remain. Water and sewage systems are in need of repair before residents can return to the camp. Many of the Lebanese army personnel killed by Fatah al-Islam were from villages around the Nahr Barid camp, and some Palestinians fear they may be victims of reprisal attacks from these villagers. For Free Speech Radio News in Beirut, this is Simba Russo.
Democratic presidential candidates gathered in a forum where issues of race and class topped the agenda. They answered questions on disparities between whites and people of color in healthcare, the criminal justice system, the education system, and the workforce. DC editor Leanne Caldwell was at last night's debate at the historically black Howard University in Washington, D.C.
The field for the Democratic nomination for president is the most diverse ever, with a woman, an African-American, and a Latino in the field. But race has not been a central part of any campaign. Former Senator John Edwards has treaded the topic with his focus on Two Americas, comparing life of the privileged to that of the disadvantaged. He expounded upon his priorities to help the poor and the middle class.
We need to ensure that Medicaid covers AIDS drugs and AIDS treatment to make sure that people get the treatment they need.
Senator Barack Obama spoke little about policy. Instead, he spoke generally about a president who can understand race divisions in the country and work to heal them. But he also devoted many of his answers to personal responsibility in the African-American community.
One of the things we've got to overcome is a stigma that still exists in our communities. We don't talk about this. We don't talk about it in the schools. Sometimes we don't talk about it in the churches. It has been an aspect of sometimes our homophobia that we don't address this issue as clearly as it needs to be.
Obama was responding to a question about crisis levels of HIV infection among blacks, especially black women. To the same question, Senator Hillary Clinton enthralled the audience with this response.
If HIV/AIDS were the leading cause of death of white women between the ages of 25 and 34, there would be an outraged outcry in this country.
When asked about disparities in the criminal justice system, many candidates had similar responses to Senator Chris Dodd.
I'm a strong supporter of Charlie Rangel's efforts here to eliminate the distinction between crack cocaine and powder cocaine. That'll have a big difference in terms of who actually goes to jail in this country.
Senator Clinton expanded a bit.
You know, mandatory sentences for certain violent crimes may be appropriate, but it has been too widely used, and it is using now a discriminatory impact.
Her husband, Bill Clinton, helped to usher mandatory minimums into the system during his presidency. Following the debate, Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee defended Clinton's position.
That this administration going forward is not a duplicate of the past administration. They may have close relationships, which is obvious. They are husband and wife. But there are enough people who are supporting Senator Clinton who are adamant against mandatory sentencing. But let me tell you why we can move forward. We have the backdrop of the failure of mandatory sentencing. And if there's anything that Senator Clinton is, an astute lawyer, keenly aware of what works and what doesn't work.
Representative Dennis Kucinich received thunderous applause throughout the debate. This time, he focused his answers on transferring resources from the war to pay for domestic issues.
I'm ready to see at least a 15% reduction in that bloated Pentagon budget, stop funding war, start funding education.
Just hours after the Supreme Court lessened the value of race in schools, education was high on the agenda. Senator Joe Biden focused on early education and education preparation.
And it widens because we do not start school earlier. We do not give single mothers in disadvantaged homes the opportunities that they need in order to know what to do to prepare their children.
Most of the candidates spoke about universal pre-kindergarten. Governor Bill Richardson separated himself by talking about a minimum wage for teachers.
The first thing you hear is how are you going to pay for it? Nobody asks how we're going to pay for the war. But it's important to state that improving our schools, improving education, access to education to all Americans should be America's foremost priority.
Former Senator Mike Gravel focused many of his answers on opposition to the war, but he did appreciate this debate over the first two.
First off, let me thank the organizers. This is the fairest debate or forum that we've had thus far this year.
PBS and Tavis Smiley hosted the debate. and the sold-out audience was filled with distinguished African-Americans and Howard University students. 19-year-old Howard student Baker Blanding was in the audience and gave his reaction.
Senator Obama, actually, after reading his book, I expected to hear a lot more from him, especially when the debate was supposed to be about, you know, specifically his people. Clinton, her passion, her knowledge of our issues and how to tackle them and her plan was very impressive. And I also say Kucinich also had a very well-rounded base. Edwards had visited Howard before, but he didn't impress me this time the way he did the first time.
Candidates are hoping that the debate spurred an influx of donations before tomorrow's quarterfiling deadline. The Republicans will appear in the same forum in September. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Army recruiters promise new enlistees tens of thousands of dollars in education benefits, but the Department of Education reports only 3% of veterans graduate from college. FSRN's Aaron Glantz reports on why that is and on a new bill introduced in Congress designed to help service members complete their degree.
Marine Corps reservist Todd Bowers was halfway through his degree in Middle Eastern Studies at George Washington University when the Pentagon pulled him out of school and sent him on two combat tours to Iraq. When he returned, he found his student loans had been sent to collection.
And I had notified my lenders I was leaving on a combat deployment, and something went awry while I was gone. And I had tremendous amounts of letters and everything else that said, you know, you owe this money. Once I came back and informed them of that, they were very understanding, and they said, no problem, we'll see what we can do, we'll get this squared away. But the damage had already been done in regards to my credit history.
That wasn't Bauer's only problem.
When I returned from a 12-month deployment on my second tour, I was given just 2 weeks to retake my finals of classes. I hadn't seen the coursework in well over 12 months.
So Todd Bowers dropped out of school. He now works as government affairs director for Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, the first and largest member organization for veterans of America's recent wars. On Thursday, the group put forward a new bill in Washington, which is sponsored by Democratic Senator Sherrod Brown of Ohio and Congresswoman Susan Davis of San Diego. The Veterans Education Tuition Support Act wouldn't increase the amount of money veterans get for college, but it would close loopholes in the GI Bill, which make finishing a degree more difficult. Patrick Campbell is former student body president at UC Berkeley and an active member of IAVA.
We have a law that says that if you get deployed, you come back and you'll have your job back. This would do the same thing. You get deployed overseas, you get your seat back. This bill, I think, is going to affect a lot of people. I mean, there are 90,000 reservists last year who are enrolled in school, and you know, I think it was about 25,000 of them had deployed at least once.
The bill would also require colleges to refund tuition for service members sent overseas, cap student loan interest payments at 6% while the student is deployed, and extend the period of time the student soldier has to re-enroll after returning from abroad. The bill is likely to receive a positive response from university administrators. Joe Volkert is Assistant Vice President for Enrollment Management at San Francisco State University.
You know, anything that would help the students be able to come back and pick up their studies if they were interrupted or to begin their studies if they hadn't done it before that. It sounds like those are all good things.
Volkert says veterans may believe university administrators are hostile when they return from a deployment. In fact, she says they legally have very little wiggle room in how they treat their students.
Basically, the rules are dictated by Title V, which is the education code that we abide by. And so that's what we have to follow. So if this is something that would then cause Title V to be more lenient in terms of students who are deployed, that seems positive.
Veterans groups are likewise optimistic about the bill's chances for passage. They believe that a bill that costs taxpayers very little money while helping veterans finish their degrees should have a relatively easy time clearing both houses of Congress before being sent to the president. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz.
Hong Kong will mark its 10th anniversary of its handover to China this Sunday. While the economy thrives, many people in the territory feel that their political demands are not being listened to. FSRN's Severine Bardon reports from Hong Kong.
It's the 1st of July. It is the day for celebration as well as for us to express our aspiration for democracy.
We want democracy!
We want democracy!
One of the greatest fears Hong Kong citizens had ahead of the return of the British colony to Chinese control in 1997 was that their democratic rights, limited until a flurry of reforms at the very end of British rule, would be lost. This apprehension seemed well-placed when Beijing tried to pass a law limiting freedom of speech in Hong Kong in 2003. Resistance culminated in a July 1st march of 500,000 protesters, and the proposal was abandoned. Since then, the handover anniversary on July 1st is also a day when Democrats rally to express their grievances. According to the Basic Law, the mini-constitution that governs Hong Kong, the territory will one day enjoy full democracy. But 10 years after the handover, China's central government continues to obstruct progress.
Our message is very simple. We want to have democratic elections as soon as possible.
Emily Lau is a member of the Legislative Council representing the Frontier Political Group.
And the message, of course, is to the government here, but even more importantly, is to the government in Beijing. And we want them to understand that Hong Kong people are not trying to have independence or to overthrow the communist government, but we're making no progress. There is no real normalization of relationship. And the central government has no dialogue with us, no communication. That is really very bad.
Jean-François Huchet is the director of the French Center for Research on Contemporary China.
We have seen some improvements in the democratic reforms set out by the Basic Law. For example, the number of elected seats in the Legislative Council has been increased. It's now half of them. But all the other large reforms have been postponed, and so have the discussions about them.
Democrats want all the members of the Legislative Council, as well as the chief executive, to be elected by universal suffrage. According to local opinion polls, about 60% of Hong Kong people are in favor of these reforms. But another problem is the marginalization of this debate in the media. Emily Lau again.
With the press freedom, they did not interfere by making laws, but they talked to the media. And as a result, the media exercise self-censorship. And there are many things that they would not report. In the past, I give a lot of interviews. Local reporters always come to me for comments. But now, locally, not one reporter has come to me. So that whatever I do, whatever I say, the Hong Kong people will not know. They just make you irrelevant, make you invisible.
The reasons behind this self-censorship combine political pressure and new patterns of ownership. Jean-François Huchet.
Newspapers have been bought out by local tycoons, who have a lot of economic interests in China. So the editorial line has changed, and some famous field journalists have left the papers. The press coverage remains different from the Chinese papers. There still is press freedom in Hong Kong. But there are also economic interests that prevent newspapers from taking a confrontational line with China.
But Democrats in Hong Kong are not ready to give up their fight. Long Hare is a famous political activist and also an elected member of the Legislative Council.
They want to keep things in control, okay? They cannot afford to let Hong Kong become one of the so-called bad examples for the mainlander. If the Hong Kong Chinese deserve a full democracy, the Chinese people in mainland will start curious, why can't they enjoy the same standard for democracy and freedom, though?
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Séverine Bardon in Hong Kong.
Across Indonesia, an estimated 7 million acres of forest are being destroyed every year to make new palm oil plantations. The Indonesian government plans to double the existing plantations in the next 5 to 8 years to meet rocketing worldwide demand. Palm oil, mixed with diesel to produce biofuel, has been hailed as a potential savior for the environment, a cleaner alternative to fossil fuel. However, closer investigation reveals carbon-rich peatland forests are being cleared to make way for the plantations, sending huge amounts of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. FSRN's Rebecca Henschke traveled across central Kalimantan to see firsthand what's taking place.
It's a misty morning after a night of rain. Birds and monkeys move through this pristine forest of majestic 30-foot-tall trees. Soon, this thick lowland rainforest in Katinang in central Kalimantan will be cleared to make way for rows and rows of palm oil trees. Bazuki Sumano, the site manager for the Macking Group, says they're just waiting for word from Jakarta and they'll start clearing 40,000 hectares of this peatland forest. This forest is home to more than 1,000 orangutans, says Nadan Hermawan from the Government Department of Conservation.
That land is virgin forest. I deeply disagree with thousands of hectares being destroyed only to create a mono-commodity palm oil plantation. Once this is cleared, we will never be able to return it to a pristine forest again. It will be lost forever.
Indonesia is opening up millions of hectares of forests in Kalimantan and Papua, much of it peatland, to produce palm oil. Sitibu is the manager of one of the existing Macking Group plantations. He claims they're using only degraded or logged land for new plantations.
We are committed to a zero-burning practice when clearing land. We also adhere to sustainable practices. That means we try to work with the least possible impact on the environment. That includes protecting the waterways, stopping erosion, and avoiding the use of damaging pesticides.
But evidence on the ground tells a very different story. I'm standing in a sea of two-year-old palm oil plants owned by the Malaysian company, the Kalim Group. For as far as the eye can see are rows and rows of small palm oil trees in the midst of burnt-out forest. I'm here with Nordin from the local group Save Our Borneo.
When we see this burnt-out forest and burning wood everywhere like this, it's damning evidence that this was once thick forest and it has been cleared by burning.
Every time peatland is cleared and burnt like this, it sends enormous amounts of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, explains Laura Green from the International Peatland Research Centre, or SINTROP, at the Palangkaraya University.
Peat Swamp Forest is one of the really, really important forests when it's concerned with climate change, because there's two features. First of all, when the trees are there, when the forest is there, they sequester carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, so they keep it inside their bark, inside their trunks, inside their leaves. And also the peat beneath them also stores the carbon dioxide and doesn't release it back into the atmosphere. And so it acts as this big storage. If you remove the trees, then obviously they're not sequestering carbon dioxide anymore. But also, because the peats become exposed, it gets burnt more frequently, it also erodes, and this allows the carbon dioxide to be released from the peat. And so rather than acting as a sink of carbon dioxide, it becomes a source and increases the level of carbon dioxide, which increases global warming.
Every year, huge forest fires from these opened and dried peatlands blanket much of Southeast Asia in toxic haze. Though it's now outlawed, locals and palm oil companies here most commonly clear land by burning it off. Travelling on a motorbike through the provincial capital, Palangkaraya, SINTROP researcher Alim tells me it's very difficult to breathe here during the fire season and your eyes sting. A report sponsored by the World Bank released in June said deforestation, peatland degradation and forest fires combined to place Indonesia among the world's top three greenhouse gas emitters. The Dutch pressure group Wetlands International says the erosion of peatland alone is producing 632 million tonnes of carbon dioxide a year. Global demand for alternative forms of energy, such as palm oil, is putting pressure on Indonesia's shrinking carbon sinks. It's an irony that the global community will need to address if green energy is going to help stop climate change rather than accelerate it. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Rebecca Henschke of Radio 68H in central Kalimantan, Borneo.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado.